Welcome to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Shear, and every once in a while, someone will ask me or one of our reporters, hey, whatever happened to so-and-so? You know, that really interesting person you interviewed back in May or June or whatever. Well, the truth is, while we often do stay in touch with a lot of these interviewees, it's actually kind of rare that we get to bring you the second act of their stories. So we are devoting this week's entire program to those second acts, with a show we are calling Follow-Ups. We'll trek back to an endangered marsh on the Potomac River to see how it's faring now.
Look, Dyke Marsh is going to be gone in 30 years unless somebody takes some action.
And we'll check in with the mother who shared a very personal tale of losing one of her twin sons.
When my son died, it was such a sad time that I wanted to give hope to someone during a really bad time in their life.
Plus, we'll follow up with the monks of Virginia's Holy Cross Abbey to see how they're faring 18 months after we shared their fight for survival.
There's plenty of money here to sustain the operation. The thing that's been the challenge is the human capital, and hopefully we've turned the corner, or starting to turn the corner on that as well.
But before we get to all that, back in June, we headed to D.C.'s Capitol Hill neighborhood, where we met this man.
Well, it was a normal day at, at Frager's, and there was our cashier, main cashier, Melinda, and I think a customer tipped her off. They smelled smoke.
John Weintraub is the owner of Frager's, the hardware store on Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast that had been serving the Washington area for more than 90 years when a cigarette butt sparked a massive fire that wound up ravaging the place.
And so then we ran around the side to 11th Street, and then I saw the flames. And the median street, just watched it burn.
And as you did so, what was going through your mind, your heart?
Crying almost.
6 months later, though, John Weintraub is finding reasons to smile. He's leased the pad at Eastern Market for his lawn and garden operation. He's rented a former auto body shop at 1323 E Street Southeast for Frager's Hardware and Rental. The temporary Frager's Paint Store is going strong at 1129 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast. And here, can you describe what we see at 1230 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast?
Well, it's pretty barren. It does have some trash that's going to be removed. It's got some concrete places that were foundations, some bricks, a few trees, and the backs of other houses.
You don't really see a whole lot now. But John Weintraub says, just you wait. Within a matter of time, what are we going to see back here?
Well, we are planning a 5,000 plus square foot temporary warehouse structure.
He and his team are hoping to have the structure up by summer, at which point
it's going to house all the varied pop-ups that Frager's now has.
At least until the original space is rebuilt. And that's a dream come true for Ricky Silverstein, one of Frager's managers. So looking ahead, do you have any New Year's resolutions when it comes to you and Frager's?
Oh yeah, one roof.
Ricky says the past few months have been quite the challenge.
Yeah, multiple locations, different topography, you know, a building with heat and air conditioning, and then the staff that has to work in the elements, and then they come over and see us in, 72 degree, we feel bad about that.
Plus, says Frager's staffer Kristen Sampson, there continues to be a whole lot of flux among the locations in terms of which place offers what.
Do you have people coming into one building thinking that this is where they have to be, but then you tell them, no, actually, you need to go to...
Yeah, you know, it ebbs and flows, so it'll kind of stabilize for a little while, and then there'll be another change. The most recent change is that the key machine moved from the pad to 1323 East Street. So if you do want keys cut, it's 1323 East Street.
And speaking of 1323 East Street, when Kristen, Ricky, and I swing by on a recent Friday afternoon, the former auto body shop is bustling.
So they're repairing glass and screens behind
you. He's cutting glass screens. He might have been actually vacuuming up the scraps. But we actually do a pretty good glass and screen repair business. Not a lot of places will cut glass and screen to custom fit sizes and stuff.
What's more, says Brenda Robinson, a local property manager and longtime Frager's customer, not a lot of places will sell the items that Frager's does.
What's an example?
Well, a certain type of parts for the water heaters, electrical parts, lots of radiator keys. It's just a lot of things that you can find here.
And if you can't find it here, she says, they'll be happy to order it for you. Yet another reason she's thrilled to have Frager's back after June's fire.
I guess accidents happen, but it really affected a lot of people. Not only in the area, I mean, just people come from all around, you know, to get things that they need.
And that's a big part of what keeps John Weintraub going. Because he says there have been plenty of ups and downs over these past 6 months, He had to let about 20 employees go. He's had to rebuild a ton of lost files and data, not to mention all the different leases he's been juggling with his pop-up stores. Most are for 1 or 2 years.
But some of the leases, the people are planning to develop the property, so the future's unknown on those.
And that's especially true for the pad at Eastern Market, which is part of the proposed Hine Junior High School development project.
There is a court case pending, and there's no time frame on that. When that's resolved, then they will begin construction in that whole area. So we'll have to leave the pad.
And that's will they give you any notice?
They'll give us notice, yes. Part of the deal is we've agreed to be able to leave within 2 weeks. So yes, that's been a source of anxiety.
But what's been a source of joy, he says, is the generous support he and his staff have been receiving from customers and organizations. We have the holidays coming up. How are you going to celebrate and look back at the year?
Well, we're having a party. We generally have a Christmas party every year. And the Capitol Hill Community Foundation raised an awful lot of money. And so we're going to be able to defray some of the costs.
Not only that, he says, but he might even be able to hand out some holiday bonuses, making this the most wonderful time of a pretty tough year. You can see how 1230 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast looks now and how Frager's hopes it'll look in the future on our website, metroconnection.org.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
With the kids jingle belling.
And everyone telling you be of good cheer.
Our next story takes us thousands of miles away to China. Earlier this year, Jacob Fenston interviewed some D.C. area moms who had adopted daughters from that country.
Children in China, because of the one-child policy, are basically abandoned, and the parents don't want to be punished for giving the child up, so they leave them in a very public place, mostly churches, police stations, farmers markets, where they know they will be immediately found and taken to an orphanage, and they'll be taken care of.
That's Janice Morris. She adopted her daughter from China in 2000, and her daughter was among the more than 60,000 Chinese babies adopted by Americans during that decade. Now, as those babies grow up, many of their families are returning to China to teach their children about their native country and native culture. Jacob checked back in with one of these families. He actually asked them to record their China trip and brings us their story.
Hi, Jacob. It's Olivia Rose. Today, it's November 24th. We're in China, and today we're going to go to the Summer Palace and the Great Wall today. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Olivia Rose Romboletti has spent almost her entire life in Reston, Virginia. But 10 years ago, she was an infant found abandoned in a shopping district in the mid-sized city of Fuling in southwest China. Around the same time, 8,000 miles away, Christine Romboletti was just beginning the international adoption process.
It's Christine Romboletti, and we are up extraordinarily early, although we're so jet-lagged, I don't think we'd know the difference.
Now, 9 years after Christine first flew to China to adopt Olivia Rose, the two have returned. They're hitting many of the sites on the tourist trail.
Yesterday, we went to the Forbidden City, and it was awesomely fun.
But there's at least one spot on their itinerary you won't find in any guidebook.
We sort of know a general location. It's 21 Zhangfu Road.
Olivia Rose's finding site, where, according to Chinese adoption officials, she was discovered abandoned when she was just 2 days old.
It's Tuesday, November 26th, and it's 5:09. And right now, if you hear any sound in the background, that's my mom packing up. We're getting ready to go to Fuling.
It's a cold, rainy day, and Olivia Rose and her mom are trudging through the hilly streets of Fuling.
One of the kind of shocks to my system when we got to Fuling was how many blocks had been completely leveled to be rebuilt. I mean, buildings, entire blocks were rubble and being completely modernized. And I thought, oh no, I felt like every minute counted until we got to that site that we wouldn't find wrecking balls.
When they got to the street, it did not look familiar.
The main thing that we were going to use to identify the location was this very distinctive tile pattern that was the sidewalk. And literally right now in Fuling, all of that tile is being replaced with these big gray concrete blocks.
So they worked their way up the street, asking the shopkeepers through a translator if they knew the location.
Okay. Show me the picture.
Finally, someone recognized a tiny detail in one of the photos.
This air conditioning unit has been moved up. They left the brackets so we could see that there had been a unit. And when you look up, they've moved the unit up higher now.
Olivia Rose wanted a memento from this spot. She doesn't know where she was born or to whom, so this place is pretty much as close as she can get to the beginning of her story. She picked up a little piece of the sidewalk.
It's a piece of the tile from one of these pictures. The tile was, like, actually loose on the ground. We had to, like, get it quickly before they would sweep it up into, like, a trash bag and throw it all away.
Olivia Rose and her mom were traveling with a group of 12 other families like theirs, Chinese girls adopted by American parents.
Hi, it's Olivia. I've gotten to know a few of my Fu sisters. I know one of my Fu sisters.
Fu sisters is what the 13 girls on the trip call each other. They were all adopted from the same orphanage in Fuling.
That's pretty much what we're doing right now. I'll record later.
Olivia Rose doesn't know anything about her birth family. Were they rich or poor? And why did they give her up? One likely reason is that her birth parents may have already had a son or daughter, and because of the one-child policy, they couldn't keep a second one. In other words, Olivia Rose may very well have an older brother or sister somewhere in China. That fact sank in whenever she saw kids about the same age heading for school or doing homework at home. At one point,
this group of 11-year-old girls came up to our girls and started practicing their English with them. And our girls were trying to speak to them in a little bit of Mandarin and English. And it was really cool. At one point, my daughter said, "Mom, they're us."
It's November 29th and it's 8:28. Today's our last day in Fuling.
Earlier in the day, Olivia Rose and her mom took one last walk around the city.
We walked around. My mom asked me how I felt, and I told my mom that I sort of feel like home here, even though I don't speak the language or don't know the characters, like how we know our ABCs. They have a different alphabet. Theirs are all characters, and I feel really good, and I sort of wish we could stay longer.
And she says they're already planning another trip back in 2015.
I sort of would like to go to the same places again to, like, just see, like, as I'm older and I may understand things better than I did this trip.
In the meantime, she plans to keep in touch with her Fu sisters scattered around the United States and maybe start taking Mandarin so next time all those characters make a little more sense. I'm Jacob Fenston.
You can see photos from the Rombolettis' journey to Fuling on our website, metroconnection.org. Time for a break, but when we get back, more than a year after coming out as transgender, a young Washingtonian takes stock.
I could have never expected what life would have had in store for me.
That and more is just ahead on Metro Connection here on WAMU 88.5.
WAMU News coverage of labor and employment issues is made possible by your contributions and by Matthew Watson, in memory of Marjorie Watson. And support for WAMU 88.5's coverage of the environment comes from the Wallace Genetic Foundation, dedicated to the promotion of farmland preservation, the reduction of environmental toxins, and the conservation of natural resources.
I'm Rebecca Shear, and welcome back to Metro Connection. Today, our theme is follow-ups, as we bring you a second chapter of sorts from some of the stories we've covered over the past year. When the story we'll revisit next aired back in February, it clearly struck a chord, judging by all the emails, tweets, and messages we received from listeners afterward. It was by Emily Berman, and she introduced us to a woman named Sarah Gray. Sarah was 12 weeks pregnant when she found out she'd be having twins. And it was at that same appointment that she found out one of the twins had a lethal birth defect called anencephaly. That's Greek for without a brain. Sarah decided to donate her son's organs to scientific research. And Emily, who again brought us the original story, is here with us now to bring us up to date on what's happened since.
That's right.
Hi, Emily.
Hey, Rebecca. So I chose to follow up on this story because it went in a really surprising direction. If you remember, Sarah Gray went on a business trip to Boston and stopped by the lab where her son's eyes were being studied. She went on a tour, and one of the lab staffers brought her over to meet one of the scientists working on that research, Dr. James Ziske.
And I remember he was just sort of eating his lunch at his desk, and she brought me over, and he looked up, and she said, "You know, this is Sarah Gray, and her son was a donor here." And he just sort of looked at me like, oh my gosh.
Gray described meeting Dr. Ziske as this moment when she knew her son was okay and she could begin to let go of her grief. And Gray and I have stayed in touch, so I know that not long after the story aired, she started working at the American Association of Tissue Banks and decided to write her master's thesis on why people choose to donate kidneys to strangers. Then, in August, I got this email. It says, "Hi, Emily. How are you? I just wanted to follow up with you. I'm going through the process to donate my kidney to Dr. Ziske, the researcher at Harvard who received the donation of my infant son's eyes." And so I read that and I was like, this story is not over.
Clearly not.
So what I did was I gave her some recording equipment to document what happened next.
And, well, what did happen next? I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but here she is donating a kidney to the guy who's using her son's eyes for his scientific research. I mean, she barely knows this guy.
Right. Well, she met him one time. But like I said, she just finished a thesis on why people make this exact decision. And in her case, she knows this guy better than a lot of people who donate kidneys. So she underwent the preliminary testing here in D.C., a blood test, urine test to make sure her kidney function was decent. Then she headed to Boston for the final screenings to make sure she was a match.
We got on the plane. We flew to Boston. We took the T to the hotel near Fenway.
Her first appointment was with a nephrologist, or kidney doctor.
So they asked me about my relationship with Dr. Ziske, and I explained the connection with my son about how he is the researcher that received my son's eyes. The nephrologist seemed a little concerned, and she said, you know, you're doing this for a psychological benefit that you may never realize. We can get close to predicting the best possible surgery for you, but we can't predict what's going to happen if the recipient never speaks to you again or never says thank you.
They also really wanted to know if she'd traveled to any jungles or tropical locales lately, which she had not.
Okay, I'm comfortable having you move on through the process.
And she passed. On to the next test. Next, she got a CAT scan to spot any abnormalities in her kidneys.
I'm getting, I think it's iodine contrast injected so that they can see if I have one or two kidneys. And also take a look at the blood vessels and make sure that the ones that they need are long enough. So far, so good.
And then she spent the afternoon taking her husband and son Callum to Skypin's Eye Research Institute at Harvard, the lab where Dr. Ziske works. She wanted her family to meet him and spend a little time together.
Since, you know, she'd be potentially donating one of her organs to him.
Right. And during their meeting, Sarah found out that Ziske's wife, three of his nephews, and a friend have all offered one of their kidneys, but none were good matches for one reason or another.
I know that me coming forward to be a possible donor for him was unusual, and I wasn't sure how he really felt about it. Like, if he thought that I was, like, a nice person, or if I was a strange person, or what.
So she asked him.
I tell people about how we met, and I usually start off by saying, this is really the most bizarre way of meeting a potential donor that I could think of.
Ziske has had kidney issues for 10 years and was put on dialysis, well, the very day she came to visit him for the first time.
Yeah, I had had an appointment that morning. There was a lot of emotion going on that day.
So when Sarah offered to go through all the testing, it seemed like it could be meant to be.
I mean, my wife totally believes in angels, and I can't possibly say I think she's wrong.
So what about the results of the CAT scan? Did she hear back?
The next day, Sarah went back to the hospital to get her results.
I talked to the transplant surgeon who pointed out some things in my CAT scan that disqualified me from donation.
Wait, did she say disqualified?
Yeah, she actually cannot donate her kidney. The imaging showed stones in her left kidney and that the veins in her right kidney weren't long enough. And they didn't want to leave her with a kidney that makes stones, and they didn't want to give Dr. Ziske that kidney either. So the surgeon did not recommend going through with the operation.
So it's over.
It's over. And she's disappointed. But in a way, she says she achieved her goal.
When my son died, it was such a sad time that I wanted to give hope to someone during a really bad time in their life. And I'm glad I tried. Like, I feel like I really did give it my all. Like, I was going to do this. And I do feel like I gave Dr. Ziske hope.
Even though it didn't work out, she says she hopes it sends a message not just to Dr. Ziske, but to anyone who needs a big karmic favor from the universe that, you know what? It just might happen.
And who knows? Maybe Dr. Ziske's donor is out there right now listening to this story.
Exactly. You never know.
Well, Emily Berman, thank you so much for bringing us up to date on Sarah Gray.
My pleasure.
If you want to find out if you might be a match for Dr. Ziske, we have a link up on our website. And for more information on kidney donation here in the D.C. area, we have links for that as well. Just check out metroconnection.org. And now, the story of another Sarah we've featured on the show, Sarah McBride. When we met her a year and a half ago, she was a rising senior at American University, and she was finishing her term as the school's student body president. She sent herself off with an op-ed in the school's newspaper. She titled it The Real Me, and in that piece, Sarah publicly came out as transgender. Until then, she had been known as Tim, and had spent years wrestling with who she really was and how she thought it might affect her dream of becoming a politician. Lauren Landau caught up with Sarah to see how she's doing now.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join us in welcoming Sarah and Sean McBride.
Back in October, Sarah McBride stepped onto the stage at the 17th annual Human Rights Campaign National Dinner. Radiating confidence in a floor-length black evening gown, she stood before the podium with her big brother, Sean, as the siblings shared their family's story.
And I consider myself very fortunate to have the life that I do. But it hasn't always been that way. I remember when I was a child, lying in my bed at night, praying that I would wake up the next day and be a girl. Have my closet filled with girls' clothes and just wanting my parents to be proud of me. I remember looking in the mirror and struggling to say just two words, I'm transgender.
But on Christmas Day in 2011, she gathered the courage to tell her family what she'd been hiding her entire life.
I think for me, with regard to my parents, my biggest fear was not that they would reject me, but that I would disappoint them.
Despite that initial anxiety, Sarah says she knew her family would continue to love and support her. But she wasn't so sure about her friends and colleagues.
I didn't come out for 21 years because I thought that everything I wanted to do with my life, have a family, get a great job, make a change in this world, that the moment I came out, that I would not be able to do any of those things.
But Sarah says that hasn't been the case. Last fall, she made history when she became the first ever transgender woman to work in the White House. Through her internship in the Office of Public Engagement, she was able to work on LGBT issues, an experience she says was among the most inspiring several months of her life.
Having the White House say, not only are you a person who needs to be respected and treated fairly, not only do you deserve equal rights, but we view you as a peer in a way that we're going to invite you into our doors and have you work here.
But she didn't stop there. A proud Delawarean, Sarah is fiercely loyal to the First State. She says she's always planned on raising a family and growing old where she grew up. So when she learned that her beloved home state lacked the kind of protections that trans people in D.C. have had for years, she was shocked.
Prior to June of this year, it was entirely legal in Delaware to fire a person because they were transgender, to not hire a person simply because they were transgender, or to fire them because they came out. It was perfectly legal to deny them insurance, deny them housing, and throw them out of a restaurant or a store simply because they were living true to themselves.
So she, her parents, and the co-presidents of LGBT advocacy group Equality Delaware, on whose board Sarah serves, fought tooth and nail to pass gender identity non-discrimination legislation in Delaware.
My parents and I were the only people outside of experts to testify before the General Assembly on this bill. And if I could have shown them one thing on those days, a few days after I came out, it would have been the image of them being embraced by the Delaware government, by our community, and by the governor over the issue of who I am.
Together, they successfully passed the Gender Non-Discrimination Act of 2013 and a marriage equality bill. But it was no cakewalk.
Being out in front and talking about some of the deepest things that for the longest time I had been ashamed to talk about, talking about that before not just the General Assembly, but in some instances the entire state, was hard and stressful.
But she had a lot of support, not only from her family, but from another clan, the Bidens. After coming out, Sarah got a call from Delaware's Attorney General Beau Biden. She'd worked for Biden during his 2006 and 2010 elections, back when she was known as Tim.
First, he used my correct name and accurate pronouns and said, "Sarah, I just wanted you to know I'm so proud of you. I love you, and you're still a part of the Biden family."
She says the cherry on top came right before President Obama's second inauguration during an event at the vice president's home.
And I went up to the vice president to get a picture. And without saying anything, the vice president saw me, and he grabbed my arm and he said, "Hey, kid, I just wanted to let you know I'm so proud of you. And Beau is so proud of you. And Jill is so proud of you. And I'm so happy that you're happy." And he gave me a big hug.
Sarah says it was inspiring to see the vice president, his family, and the governor of Delaware embrace not only her, but also the broader transgender community.
I was afraid that all of the work that I had done in my life would be for naught, and that these people who I had looked up to, the vice president, the attorney general of Delaware, the governor of Delaware, that those people would say, "You're just too much of a liability." That was my fear, and it has been the exact opposite.
She says the experience has made her appreciate the need to fight for equality across the board.
If I'm not at the same time seeking to end discrimination against people of color, seeking to end discrimination against women, seeking to ensure that people of every religious background have an equal opportunity, if I'm not working to ensure that regardless of the wealth of your family that you're born into, that you have a fair chance at a good job and a fulfilling life, if I'm not working towards all of those goals, then one, I'm leaving a lot of people behind, and two, I'm only going to be solving the problems for the most privileged in my own community.
Sarah says there's still a lot of work to be done, but she's heartened to see society moving in that direction.
Now that I know that Delaware is safe and welcoming, I want to go back home. I want to go back to where my family is, where I was born and raised, and I want to get back involved there and continue the work that I've been doing all my life, which is to engage in the political process and in government to better our society, to make things a little fairer and a little more equal for everyone.
I'm Lauren Landau. Time for our weekly trip around the region. On today's Door to Door, we visit Ashburn, Virginia, and the Parkwood neighborhood of Bethesda, Maryland.
My name is Cynthia Smith. I am 43 years old, and I live in Ashburn, Virginia. Ashburn, Virginia is located northwest of Washington, D.C. It's located between the Herndon area and Leesburg. Ashburn originally was a farming community, and then as the developers built the houses, it's built up. Initially, there wasn't a lot of restaurants, a lot of people, and then as more businesses move in, you get different restaurants, a different mix of people, different ethnic restaurants, which is really nice. So it's been nice just to see it all grow and develop. We do have horses here. My daughter loves to horseback ride, so we have access close by to horseback riding. Whether it be here in Ashburn, believe it or not, we do have access to that, or you can go out towards Leesburg and Percival. In Ashburn, there is a huge technology sector. You have a lot of data centers, more data centers being built. But it seems like a lot of people still are government contractors, and that requires most of the time being on site. It's a small town feel. You don't feel like you're constantly in a mad rush to go everywhere. You do have the trails and the community feeling of people knowing who you are, but then also the easy access into D.C. or if you want to go up to Baltimore, wherever you want to go, it's not far away.
My name is Cliff Balcom, and I live in the Parkwood neighborhood in Bethesda. The Parkwood neighborhood is in North Bethesda. It is bounded on the south and west by Beach Drive and Rock Creek Park, on the east by Summit Avenue and Cedar Lane, and on the north by Knowles Avenue. The Parkwood neighborhood was built originally, I believe, in the early 1950s. A lot of the houses that were built in Parkwood were small brick houses, probably not much bigger than the apartments out of which people were moving to occupy them. It was built up some more in the later 50s, a different style of housing, and was pretty stable for about the next 30 or 40 years or so. And then starting in the 90s, a lot of these houses began to be upgraded in a big way, or even torn down to the ground, and new, much larger houses built in their place. I would say the first thing that makes Parkwood unique is its proximity to Rock Creek Park and the wonderful park creek itself and the jogging or bicycling path that is there, which many residents use to walk, cycle, or jog, as I do. Parkwood is a great place to live. You feel like you're still right next to Rock Creek Park, and the trees, the weather, and the people are all great.
We heard from Cliff Balcom in Parkwood and Cynthia Smith in Ashburn. If you think your neighborhood should be part of Door to Door, send an email to metro@wamu.org. And to see a map of all the doors we've knocked on so far, visit our website, metroconnection.org. After the break, we return to Clark County, Virginia, and follow up with the monks at Holy Cross Abbey.
Sadly, we lost two monks. Two monks passed away earlier this year, but we've also had two new men come and have now joined as novices.
It's coming up on Metro Connection here on WAMU 88.5. Back to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Shear, and this week we're bringing you up to date on stories from months past in a show we're calling Follow-Ups. Earlier in the hour, we heard how a beloved DC hardware store is rising from the ashes of a devastating fire that hit in June. And in just a bit, we'll see what's been happening at a shrinking wetland that we visited about a year ago. But first,
Holy Father,
in July of 2012, we took you to Berryville, Virginia, to the 1,200-acre Trappist monastery known as Holy Cross Abbey. Nestled in the shadow of the Blue Ridge Mountains, right along the Shenandoah River, Holy Cross was founded in 1950 and was once home to 60 monks of all ages. When we visited, the Brotherhood had dwindled to 13 monks with an average age in the mid-70s. Their fruitcake business had been dwindling, too. But things were looking up financially. The brothers had recently leased some of their land to organic farmers, and they were starting a natural cemetery, an environmentally friendly burial ground for people of all faiths. At the time, Brother Barnabas Brownsey, who was 78, was full of hope.
I think we're going to have sufficient revenue to continue to go on.
Well, a year and a half later, it seems Barnabas was right. The organic farm is thriving, 60 people have purchased plots in the cemetery, and as of earlier this month, all 1,200 acres of the monastery went into perpetual conservation easement.
There. In the name of all the brothers of Holy Cross Abbey, it is now in permanent easement in Clark County.
That's Father Robert Barnes, Holy Cross's 72-year-old abbot, at the easement signing ceremony in one of the abbey's libraries.
Let's go back over to where the champagne is.
As Father Robert explains, what the monks have done by signing this contract
is to guarantee that this land will never go into any kind of development, but will always remain rural, natural, agricultural use. And so should we ever need to sell this land, we're giving away prospective buyers who would want to pay a very fine price to do development on it.
Which is thrilling for many people in Clark County, since now the county has more than a fifth of its land under conservation easement. As Father Robert points out, that's quite a contrast from the rapidly developing counties next door.
We're right between Loudoun County and Frederick County, and we're sort of the little boy yelling, "Look at me!" Those big guys on each side of us. So Carr County is making a name for itself in the state.
In exchange for putting Holy Cross's land under easement, the monks will receive about $2.5 million from the Department of the Interior and the Virginia Department of Historic Resources. That's because the monastery is located on historic land. Back in 1864, it was the site of the biggest Civil War battle in Clark County.
The Battle of Cool Spring. It's nothing like Gettysburg or Antietam, but for our local history, it's a very important land.
But going back a bit to what Father Robert said about should we ever need to sell this land, I mean, the monastery's financial footing is getting more and more solid.
And that's all well and good, but what if we don't have people joining us? We're very much aware that we're shrinking.
Indeed. Since the last time we visited Holy Cross, two monks have died, and three, including Father Barnabas Brownsey, are now in a nursing home run by the Daughters of Charity. But here's the thing.
We've also had two new men come and have now joined as novices, and they seem like they've been very good additions to the community here.
As Holy Cross's chief sustainability officer, Ed Leonard, has been heading up efforts like the organic farm and the natural cemetery. And he says one of the new men first visited the Abbey on a retreat.
And liked the life and asked the monastery if he could actually come here and be what's called an observer, which is the period before formally becoming a monk.
The other man came from New York City,
where he was a Capuchin monk in the past, went back to civilian life, and then decided he really liked the idea of being a monk, and now he's formally in the process of becoming a member of the community here.
Leonard says both men are in their late 50s, early 60s.
So, relatively speaking, they're older, but in terms of the community, they would bring the average age down here. So from a human capital standpoint, the monastery is actually beginning to turn itself around.
If somewhat slowly. Jillian Behrens is the Easement Program Stewardship Council with the Virginia Department of Historic Resources. As such, she helped draft the 55-page conservation easement contract with Holy Cross Abbey.
We had to draft our easement in a different way than we would normally for, say, a private property owner, because we have to accommodate their religious use. And we had to ask them to think broadly in terms of what is your religious activities, what is your religious mission, and what might it be in 50 years.
And figuring that out, she says, was and is no small task.
Look, there's 12 members. Their average age is 75. And they don't know where they'll be, never mind in 50 years, but in 10 years. And so one of the things we had to think about was, okay, what are the likely future uses of this property should the monastery cease to exist?
It may seem like a harsh question, but as Father Robert willingly admits, it's a fair one.
The world has changed so much from the time when I entered back in the early 60s. People don't understand how monastic life can be meaningful for them. They don't make quick decisions anymore. They have to ponder this. They have to weigh that. They have to think about all their involvements and all their commitments and everything. Nothing like that for me. At 19, I realized my big sacrifice I was making was my mother's cooking.
That's why when new people express interest in joining Holy Cross, Father Robert says he tries to stay realistic.
We tell everyone who comes, you're here to discern what God wants you to do. We're going to help you find if he wants you here. If he does, that's wonderful. But if he is calling you to somewhere else, we're going to help you find that. That's our part of the bargain with God.
Several new observers are coming to Holy Cross Abbey in January. And of course, whether they'll choose to remain is unknown. But what is known is that, if nothing else, the monastery's land will remain, just as it is, for generations to come. To see photos of Holy Cross's conservationally eased 1,200 acres, visit our website, metroconnection.org. Staying in Virginia, we'll head back to a spot we visited more than a year ago, Dyke Marsh. It's one of the last freshwater tidal wetlands on the Upper Potomac River and has been eroding for years. Environmental advocates say the wetland could very well disappear in just a few decades. But as environment reporter Jonathan Wilson tells us, things may be looking up.
Brent Sturry is trudging through frozen winter grass along the banks of a path known as the Hall Road.
Occasionally, he leans precariously over the marsh to take a closer look at the reedy plants sticking up from the mud. He's looking for something called river bulrush. It's a type of sedge rare enough to be on the list of endangered species in Virginia. Dyke Marsh is one of the only places in the state where it grows.
See that one come up that's broken off halfway up and hanging down?
Yep.
That's a river bulrush.
Sturry says it's likely that river bulrush was much more plentiful here before Dyke Marsh started shrinking. The path that we're on, the Hall Road, is part of that story. The road got its name, H-A-U-L, because it was built in the 1930s, when construction companies needed a road on which to haul the sand and gravel they were dredging out of the bottom of the Potomac. The dredging took its toll on the marsh.
If you squint your eyes and look over there towards 495, you can see a white buoy out in the middle of the river. That's where the edge of the marsh used to be. You can see where it is today.
Dyke Marsh once covered several hundred acres. The dredging and the erosion that's taken place since it stopped in the 1970s has shrunk the marsh by more than half. And a recent study by the U.S. Geological Survey showed the dredgers compounded the problem when they dug away a thumb-shaped promontory about 10 acres in size, a finger of land that once protected the wetland from damaging storm waves.
When they mined it, they had to create these deep channel scars all along the edge of the marsh so that the barges could get in to ship the material out. So now the wave energy can come right up to the very edge of the marsh before the waves crest and break, and they release all their energy on the marsh.
And so, at this time last year, scientists finally had a handle on all the reasons why nearly 2 acres of the marsh were disappearing each year, and why the marsh was particularly vulnerable to north-tracking storms, storms like Hurricanes Sandy and Isabel. But Glenda Booth, president of the nonprofit Friends of Dyke Marsh, had little reason to believe that the millions of dollars in federal assistance needed to restore the marsh were likely to come through.
Given what's going on in the Congress and the National Park Service's needs nationwide, finding funds to restore Dyke Marsh was going to be very challenging.
Part of Brent Sturry's job was applying for a chunk of money that the Department of Interior had available for restoration efforts after Hurricane Sandy. Sturry is a soft-spoken government biologist, about as even-keeled as you would expect of someone who studies the life cycles of aquatic plants and animals. But as he describes finding out that his grant application was successful this fall, he gets, well, a little breathless.
They wanted me to write the press release, and I said, I don't even know how much money we're getting yet. How much are we getting? And the person who was doing the national press release wrote me back and said, you're getting the full amount, $24.9 million. I was like, wow.
Right now, the Park Service is in the midst of studying exactly how the money will be used, but rebuilding the promontory section of the wetland will certainly be key. Sturry says he'll likely have to write another grant application for funding to deal with all the invasive vine species suffocating the swamp forest on the other side of Hall Road. But for now, he can get some solace from the fact that his arguments for saving Dyke Marsh are getting the attention he always thought they deserved.
We know how fast it's going away. We know why it's disappearing. Look, Dyke Marsh is going to be gone in 30 years unless somebody takes some action.
And now, thanks to a little hard work and a lot of hard science, someone is. I'm Jonathan Wilson.
We'll close out today's show with On the Coast, Brian Russo's series from the eastern shore of Maryland and coastal Delaware. All year long, Brian has been covering the Chesapeake Bay and the often rocky relationship between environmentalists and farmers when it comes to protecting the 200-mile-long estuary. This week, Brian follows up on the issue by bringing us a story about wood chips, as in the stuff you put in your yard as mulch. So how do these chips tie into the Chesapeake Bay? Well, environmentalists say these chips can suck up a lot of the pollution that would otherwise trickle in. And now those environmentalists are working to install wood chip bioreactors on several Eastern Shore farms. Brian Russo spoke with Drew Coslow, the Chop Tank Riverkeeper, who's been working on the project with local farmers, to learn how these bioreactors work.
So tell me a little bit about where we are. We're in Centerville, Maryland. We are in a huge farm. This is the Mason Heritage Farm. Tell me a little bit about this place and what this wood chip bioreactor is.
Okay, well, a lot of farms on the Eastern Shore have drain tile networks or drainage ditch networks to remove excess water and allow them to get onto their fields in the springtime. This farm is no exception, as is the other farm where we installed one of these bioreactors. And what we're doing is taking advantage of the water collection system, whether it's the ditch or in these cases the drain tile network, and we're running that water through a natural filter.
And now, that's the wood chips.
That's the wood chips. So the wood chips provide an environment for bacteria that eat the nitrate, which is the mobile form of nitrogen, out of the water. And they convert it to nitrogen gas, which is 70% of the air we breathe. And the beauty of it is that it's a natural process. It occurs in first order streams like this one we see right in front of us. Mm-hmm. The contact the water has with woody vegetation, with plant material in the floodplain, that's where you get your nutrient processing. So what we're doing is putting that into a confined area, the wood chip pit, and running our water through and trying to keep as long a retention time of the water in the wood chips as we can. And each site is going to be a little site specific, but in Iowa, where these things were developed, they found to be very effective at removing nitrate, relatively inexpensive to put in the ground, edge of field technology, so you don't take land out of production, and very low maintenance over their lifespan, which is between 15 and 30 years.
In looking at this farm, this is a huge space. And what we're looking at here, this particular site where we're, you know, you guys are installing this reactor, is seemingly a drop in the bucket of land space, comparatively speaking. Tell me about what impact, and I guess what sort of success rates you're seeing on a project like this on a farm of this scale.
This project is going to treat about 60 acres of land that drains through this drain tile network. The cost to install it's about $19,000, including our design. We got to thank the Maryland Department of Natural Resources for providing the money for us to do this. Our group, Midshore Riverkeepers, sees our role as trying to help farmers, you know, as being part of the same community. And I know, you know, each waterkeeper group has a different approach. Ours is, at the moment, is to try to be collaborative. We feel like, as difficult as it is, as hard, as uncomfortable as the relationship is between environmental groups and farmers, it's in each of our best interests to try to work together, try to develop practices that are going to work so that we have tools, so that we give farmers tools to help them meet our goals.
If this sort of technology becomes mainstream here on the shore, you know, let's say in the next decade, more and more mm-hmm. farmers are utilizing this. How much impact do you think that is going to make on the larger issue of keeping clean waterways in the Chesapeake Bay and improving that relationship between environmentalists and farmers?
The potential difference that this kind of project can make is really large. And the beauty of it is it's a one-time installation and you let the project do its job. And you know, I've been in the business for 20 years, and I've always said, if you want to see what a polluter looks like, look in the mirror. And in my mind, we're all in this together, and the more collaboration, particularly between groups that are typically adversarial, you know, the more collaboration you get, the better.
That was Drew Coslow, the Chop Tank Riverkeeper at the Midshore Riverkeepers Conservancy, talking with Coastal reporter Brian Russo. And that's Metro Connection for this week. We heard from WAMU's Jacob Fenston, Emily Berman, Jonathan Wilson, Brian Russo, and Lauren Landau. WAMU's managing editor of news is Memo Lyons. Metro Connection's managing producer is Tara Boyle. Lauren Landau is our editorial assistant. Lauren Landau and John Hines produce Door to Door. Thank you, as always, to the WAMU engineering and digital media teams for their help with production and the Metro Connection website. Our theme song, Every Little Bit Hurts, and our door-to-door theme, No Girl, are from the album Title Tracks by John Davis and used with permission of the Ernest Jennings Record Company. You can find all the music we use each week on metroconnection.org. Just click on a story, and you'll find information about its accompanying song. And if you missed part of the show today, you can stream the whole thing on our website by clicking the This Week on Metro Connection link. You can also subscribe to our podcast there or find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and the NPR News app. We hope you can join us next week when we'll bring you our annual Hall of Fame show featuring some of our favorite stories from 2013. We'll shadow a rookie cop on the overnight shift. We'll go mining for gold in Maryland. And we'll meet a filmmaker trying to document the culture in D.C.'s Chinatown before that culture disappears.
Business is booming here, and it's great for developers. However, for Chinese immigrants who want to live here, it becomes more difficult.
I'm Rebecca Scheer, and thanks for listening to Metro Connection, a production of WAMU 88.5 News.